Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 108, we're in Sydney, where we'll be discussing the city's urban design challenges and finding out what it takes to be one of our most livable cities.
Sydney is the quintessential city in nature. The city's such a spectacularly beautiful place. And I've just come back from China. And when you come back, you think, oh, you've gone from black and white to colour.
That was architect and urban designer Craig Alchin, and we'll be touching down in Singapore to find out why the government is turning to Lady Gaga to inspire its homegrown businesses.
Yes, you may be good in certain area, you may be good in service, you may be good in product, but can you make it such that your customers are so fascinated by you? It becomes more like obsession and addiction.
That was Ping Chong Boon, Executive Director of Singapore's Enterprise Development Agency, Spring. And later in the program, we'll be taking a culinary tour of Sydney with leading food writer and restaurant critic, Jill Duplay.
We want our young chefs and baristas and bar people to be of their generation. We don't want them to copy what's going on in the world. Give us the best of the world, but give it to us in our own Australian way.
And now, the Monocle Weekly.
Hello, it's Sunday, July 17th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in Sydney at the studios of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation with me, Tyler Berlay, and Andrew Tuck. Hello, Andrew.
Hello there.
We won't go into the events of last night.
We'll
come to those later. But it's been a bit of a whistle stop so far, a little bit of Singapore, a little bit of Sydney. It's been 5 years since you've been here, and we can come to that later. But first stop, Singapore. Did you enjoy?
Yeah, I did. It was very brief. It was a 24-hour whirlwind through the city, but it was great. And it was just really interesting to kind of, you know, be there in the market and meet our subscribers, you know, and meet so many people. We did an event where 200 people, obviously more than 200 people, came through in the evening, and just really interesting people, really amazing community. And I think we'd both said we wonder how many people would be expats, but it was actually a Singaporean crowd. And, you know, it was amazing to see the support we have there.
And up until Wednesday, Wednesday morning, until you stepped off the aircraft, you were a Singapore virgin.
An absolute Singapore virgin. And I certainly need to go back, because, you know, 24 hours is certainly no way to kind of judge anywhere. But first impressions were very good. You know, I met really, really interesting people.
I think one of our highlights was lunch in the Dempsey Village area with our friends from the Ministry of Defence. Well, they've become our friends from the Ministry of Defence, which was interesting that you're talking to, of course, as it was pitched, and I think as they would believe as well, that they're perhaps one of the fittest fighting forces in Southeast Asia, or certainly in the broader neighbourhood. And I liked one of the Brigadier General's comments that he felt that when we want to do a story, that it was like being asked out by Nicole Kidman.
I know, but
which is sort of, it was just not the Ministry of Defence language that I was expecting.
And he was funny, because he took that analogy on quite a long way, wondering whether, you know, when we'd phoned up and wanted to do a story about the Defence Department, that actually, were we phoning the wrong person? Does Nicole Kidman really want to go out with me? But also, it's just an intriguing crowd anyway, that from the ministry, because in fact the women didn't look like they were actually working behind kind of civil services desks. They looked,
well, not when you have a Chanel handbag that big, as the one public affairs lady had.
No, amazing little turned out crowd. And but also, again, you know, we know so much about Singapore, but it was interesting just to hear them kind of speak about their country and what they were doing defence wise as well.
First impressions. I mean, as you said, we had the event, and we ran around to a lot of meetings, so you didn't see a lot of the city. But I mean, obviously, we've talked a lot about Singapore from a first impressions point of view.
Well, I think one of the things that strikes you immediately as you land in Singapore and you make that journey into the city is that kind of seamless drive, you know, a straight road, beautifully planted, amazing first impressions. Mm. So there's a real, you know, there's no kind of, you know, most cities when you arrive, you see some kind of hideous housing, and, you know, living near the airport is never a good thing for most people, but they don't have any of that. You just get this beautiful kind of ride into the city. So you arrive in Singapore feeling kind of quite impressed. And it's not one of those places in Asia where the airport's like 10 miles away from the actual city centre as well. So I think we managed to land, collect bags, and actually be in our hotel rooms in about 50 minutes.
Once into the city, I'm wondering what you felt. I mean, we were in the Orchard Road area, but, you know, as you sort of continue with that, because I found it surprising at when we were talking to our subscribers, how many of them, they didn't give us a hard time, but the issue of transport came up a lot. And a lot of people said, God, you're quite easy on this place, because they said, oh, you know, transport's a nightmare, and they're digging up everywhere because of the, you know, they're laying new rails for, more light rail, et cetera. And I thought that was interesting, because on one side I thought, well, friends, you know, we can buy you an Oyster card and you can come to London if you want to experience tricky transport.
Yeah, I think the Singaporeans are quite hard on their home territory, because you know it has been an incredibly efficient, simple system. And the city is growing, the city is expanding, and more people are moving there. So of course there are some pressures on the system, but as you say, compared to kind of anywhere else, it's a little kind of Swiss watch of a transport system.
Yeah, one thing that struck me on this trip though is that I feel that Singapore is moving into that next phase, and I know we've often talked about the second, third, even fourth wave in South Korea, and how that economy, not just from an economic perspective but also from a cultural perspective, is always reinventing itself. And I feel that Singapore is at that, it's almost at that tipping point right now, where they've defined themselves, of course, as an incredible logistics hub, and the advances that they've made technology wise and certainly the supremacy that they have as a financial center in this region. But I think now you wonder, what do they do service sector wise, and I think also from a cultural perspective as well. And I know that was one thing we were chatting to the Minister of Defense about, because that whole notion of soft power came up, and we said, well, it raises the question, where are the pop stars? Where is the Singaporean Nicole Kidman?
Yeah, I think that was a good discussion. Will there be a Singaporean pop star who can kind of take brand Singapore and push it around the region? And that doesn't exist yet. And as you say, all the hotels are there, but are they doing as good a job as the ones in Tokyo? Or are they really ramping things up and making a kind of their known quality of service and kindness and generosity? Are they making it into a brand that really sells Singapore these days?
Yeah, and I think it's almost transferring here, because we had a conversation with someone from the tourism side in Australia at our event, and that was it was one surprising discussion, because when you talk about countries, within the Asia Pacific region that score incredibly high, just in terms of, if you poll people in Taiwan or Vietnam or Hong Kong and ask them where they want to go, it's Australia or it's Japan. And what struck me about that is that sense of authenticity, because you come to Australia and it is quite an authentic, it's a very unique experience. You can't get that experience anywhere else. And you feel the same thing goes for Japan, where sometimes you wonder if a lot of the marketing campaigns from Southeast Asia, they all tend to blend into each other slightly.
Yes. But it's interesting, isn't it? Again, because, yesterday we had quite a few conversations with people who were talking about, again, it's a place where people are quite tough on their city. We come to Sydney, we know the things we like. There are many things that are appealing about it. But actually many Sydney-siders were saying the same things to me last night. They're saying, I wish we had a kind of a better hotel brand. I wish we had, I wish we could raise things a little bit higher on the kind of service side to do with the places you stay, and that there was a kind of broader variety of places to eat, which I don't think is really true, especially on the food side. You come here and you're always amazed. But maybe on the hotel side, even here, they're kind of wondering what happens next.
Yeah, later in the program, our producer Alex Mills, and also our business correspondent editor Jonathan Openshaw, they're going to be chatting to Ping Chung Boon, who's from Spring, which is the enterprise agency. And there is this big discussion in Singapore, I think, where they realize they have to up their service game. And they'll be chatting to him later in the show. And it's funny, because in the intro I was reading about how they want to have Lady Gaga style service. And I'm not sure if that was just an excuse for Alex to play Lady Gaga on the show later today. But just coming back here, we're going to be talking more with Craig Elchin in a moment. But just first impressions, it's been 5 years since you've been here. What have you noticed?
Well, first of all, just the time of year, I like being here. Actually, I've been here before in winter, and actually it's a great city even in the winter. It's a strange thing that most people think you should only come to Sydney when it's kind of summer. But in fact, these kind of dry blue sky bits,
wasn't so blue sky on Friday, but anyway,
this morning the blue sky, it's a great city. I think there are many things that you come to Sydney that you don't want to kind of change. So actually, literally, when we were off the plane yesterday, we went straight to Bill's for breakfast. That was the welcome doormat you want to step across first thing when you arrive in Sydney. I think, yeah, I'm looking forward to exploring more today. But, you know, again, last night, just speaking to people about their city, and this is obviously going to come up in the show, a real sense that, you know, that things are happening on the urban front here that are really interesting, whether it's people talking about, you know, cycleways or the more density in the city, that just people really were kind of geared up for kind of how the quality of life was changing here and things were good.
Well, in a moment, we're going to talk about the challenges and also what lies ahead on the horizon with architect and urban designer Craig Alchin here in Sydney. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in Sydney. And just before we went to the break, we said that Craig Alchin would be joining us, and here he is. And I guess, Craig, as Andrew was mentioning beforehand, it's, you know, this city from a first impression point of view, and I think, Andrew, we've probably been coming here for probably a good 2 decades now, even though you've had a bit of a hiatus. I'd been away for about 4 years. I came back last October, November, and it's great to sort of be back here half a year later. A couple of things that, I mean, you do see that there are, you know, a number of initiatives that are going on. Certainly, there's you know, a lot of land cleared. You can see sort of in the back part of the bay. There's a lot of construction on the horizon. But I guess the key thing, you know, what do you think the city's doing well right now? And then we can come to the challenges in a moment.
Well, I think Sydney is the quintessential city in nature. You know, and so I think as Australia increasingly becomes part of Asia, I guess, and we realise that, you know, our place in the world is with the future of China and India and Singapore you were talking about before. Mm. I think our point of difference is that the city is such a spectacularly beautiful place. And I've just come back from China. And when you come back, you think, oh, you've gone from black and white to colour when you hit Sydney Harbour.
Right.
And I think so that the whole of the sort of eastern Sydney is just as livable. And I think getting a little bit more urban, you were just mentioning before the food, you know, there's great food in Sydney. I think the inner city thing is happening a bit more in Sydney than, and it's kind of catching up to what Melbourne's been doing the last 20 years or so. So I think it's increasingly livable, but there's, you know, there's plenty of challenges as well.
I mean, do you think there's that recognition on the part of city government and regional governments within the state here as well, that is the point of difference, that's what they should be working on, you know, vis-a-vis, you know, developments in Thailand and China and elsewhere?
Well, I think people realise that, and since the Opera House, really, even before that, the Harbour brand and the Opera House brand is Sydney and is Australia in a way, and I think that's kind of been exploited pretty well. And so I think, you know, we've got plenty of executives coming to Australia to situate their Asian headquarters because of the, you know, livability and the great schools and so on. So I think there's a recognition of that, but I think one of the big questions is we have to get beyond being the city in nature and we have to be a real city. Mm. And I think the kind of, since the conservation movement in the 70s, really, Sydney suffered because everyone started to say, well, development's bad, nature's good. And you can sort of sense that out in the suburbs where everyone, even the regulations now, people are starting to say, make sure the houses are below the trees and let's just kind of have this beautiful life in nature. When, I don't know if you've read that, the new Ed Glaser book, The Triumph of the City, which I thought was just fantastic. It's all about, you know, cities are about economic development and we need to actually intensify our cities. And in Australia, our cities are growing really rapidly. We've got some big projections on population growth. Mm. And so we actually need to get some productive capacity in the city. So I think our real challenge in Sydney is to say, well, hang on, we love nature, but we can, and I call it we need a contrasting urbanism. I think, you know, New York and Central Park is, the beauty of it is it's kind of big created nature with strong urbanism right next to it. Mm. And in Sydney, we've got a little bit of that from the 60s, but we've abandoned that idea and we get scared by it. And I think both would benefit if we can actually get a strong urban condition and a strong natural condition.
And what about the problem which is always kind of brought up about Australian cities, this idea of urban sprawl? Is that containment of the city happening now? Will that inevitably force, you know, people to come back to the city centre to kind of actually start that kind of growth that you're talking about?
I think that's sort of happening a little bit naturally as this kind of the Gen Ys get wise to the idea of an urban life. So I think a lot of younger people want to come in and when they're in their 20s, they want to live this kind of new funky life. You can live in the city, in the close to the downtown, in the inner suburban areas, in Sydney, it's Newtown and Glebe and Chippendale and Surry Hills and Darlinghurst and so on. And even Bondi in a way has kind of got a nice urban density. So I think there's an increased demand for that sort of life. And in my view, the idea of everybody wants to kind of nick off to the suburbs and live a quiet life, it's changing.
Mm.
And there's been some studies done by the government here that have said, you know, there's perhaps a structural shift in the market. But the problem is there's not much capacity left in this inner urban area. So people are in Sydney increasingly looking for somewhere to live that they want to live. And I think fewer people want to move out to the suburbs, but there's fewer and fewer choices.
Right.
Whereas Melbourne, by contrast, has vast plains that it can spread out to, and it's continuing to spread, although the inner urban area is intensifying because there's still plenty of industrial land there. A bit like New York and London, there's plenty of industrial supply that you can keep filling up.
Yeah.
So I think one of the problems for Australia is there's this, and Melbourne in particular is becoming a little bit of a Paris, I think. It's got this fantastic inner urban vibe going. Everyone increasingly wants to live there. There are 1,500 people a week, I think, moving to Melbourne, or it's increasing by. But then the suburbs are still spreading out. And so we're going to potentially end up with that same kind of problem of this inner urban bit that's fantastic, well served by bike paths and transport, and then the suburbs are still rolling out.
I mean, it is a big discussion too, is because Melbourne could quite easily, I guess projections are that Melbourne will probably overtake Sydney population wise as well if economic trends and then as you said, sort of the attraction continues at the same pace. And there's certainly quite an ongoing and healthy fight between the two cities.
Yeah, yeah, there is, and I think that's really healthy. I think we can take a lesson from China, where, you know, China central government has kind of designated Beijing as the cultural capital, Shanghai as the financial capital, and Guangzhou as the entrepreneurial kind of theme park city.
Yeah.
And I think we have a bit of a similar structure in Australia with Melbourne as the cultural capital. And I think in Sydney, we have to kind of acknowledge that in a way. Sydney's the dynamic international financial capital.
Yeah.
And Brisbane, possibly the bit of white shoe developer, is in some ways the entrepreneurial city. So I think healthy rivalry is good, but we could probably actually strengthen each city's position and push more along that area rather than trying to compete on the same ground.
I mean, you touched on some of the more attractive suburbs, and I guess if you're living in more of the hinterland of Australia, that you might want to move to Newtown or Glebe or Surrey Hills. I'm wondering how much benchmarking is being done at a government level where people are saying, okay, here's a stretch of commercial. Here's a parade of shops and businesses in Bondi. This works really well, and so this is what we should try to replicate elsewhere. Is there that recognition, or is it let's just put another mixed use shopping mall and make sure it's well air conditioned, and then we've done our job, and we'll in fact we'll just outsource that to Westfield.
Well, there's a bit of that. Rouse Hill's a new development out in the suburbs, which Lendlease have built, and it's a kind of main street mall. So it's open air main street, but with the big department stores in a circuit, and it's in amongst a new development area. It's a better model than an internal mall. It's got a main street, it's got a library, community square, and so on. But it's still a one company project.
Right.
But I think the really interesting part of Sydney is the sort of middle ring and some of the outer areas where there's a really strong ethnic grouping. So Cabramatta's got a Vietnamese community, really strong Vietnamese community, and lots of camps. He's got a strong Chinese community. There's lots of great spots even on the North Shore as well. So I think those things are happening naturally. One of the problems is our regulations won't allow those places to develop as intensely as they need to. So,
and is that changing though? I mean, is there a recognition that maybe the regulations that exist right now are perhaps a little bit out of pace? Or,
well, in my view, we've set ourselves a very difficult task in Australia. The sort of NIMBYism that is existing across many developed world cities is really affecting our targets. Sydney, I've worked on the state government strategy for Sydney, and we have a target. I think it's up to going from around 4.5 to 6 million by 2036, and then up to 7 million by 2050, and that's a lot of growth. It's sort of as much growth as New York and London, but we're only a third the size, so it's really significant growth. Yet we've run out of our industrial supply generally, so we need to intensify existing urban areas. And almost all the plans in Australia, the capital city plans, suggest that we're going to turn existing housing into higher density. But the problem with that is actually there's no real example of it anywhere in the world where they've taken happy middle-class houses and renewed them.
Mm.
You know, it's always happened in areas of urban blight or industrial areas or government-owned areas.
Yeah.
So we have this big challenge, which is a sleeper, and the government doesn't really want to identify it because, we don't want to start saying, okay, we're buying up your houses. The developers can't really do it either because there's too much uncertainty for them to go, okay, I'm going to buy this house and negotiate over this one and then get another three so I can do a decent development. So we need to really think about a slightly new model of how to acquire land and have effectively a land release program within the cities.
It was interesting speaking to people last night. One thing that came up two or three times that people thought that Sydney had got better in the centre for a strange piece of regulation being changed, which was to do with the licensing laws,
yep.
which had changed to allow you to open smaller bars and not everyone's some like barn-like pub. Has that actually had a real impact on the way that the kind of city centre feels, do you think?
I think it's just starting to. I did 10 years as an architect in Melbourne and was heavily involved in that whole urban revitalisation of downtown in Melbourne. And it happened because of the big recession, really, and the licensing laws changed. A few things came together and Melbourne now has 300 little bars in the downtown alone and, you know, good little bars in the main streets, and it's expanding out. Sydney had regulation which was very much in favour of the big pubs and clubs, and so you couldn't open a small bar. You had to have a hotel licence or nothing. And now the licensing has changed a little bit, probably not enough, but enough to actually allow people to push through and get some licences. So I think it's terrific. It's just starting. It took Melbourne kind of 10 years to get its kind of small bar mojo going and make a kind of culture of good places to go and so on. Sydney's catching up quickly. I think there's 50 or 60 little restaurant bars that have opened. And I think we're really just catching up to what a normal city should be. You know, it's what you expect, I think, from a city which is dense. In Paris, the little bars, they're just a normal part of the fabric. You know, in the bottom of the 6-story building, you have breakfast in there, you can have lunch, you can have dinner or a drink. So I think we're starting to get to that culture in Sydney where, you know, the inner urban areas are serviced with the things you expect. And then beyond that, I think it's exciting what might happen.
You're making us thirsty. We should probably go to a break. Craig Alton, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
Thank you. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly in Sydney. We're back after this. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly here in Sydney. Well, it's been a troubled 2 weeks for the newspaper industry over in the UK, with no signs of the media storm ending anytime soon. But what impact might News Corp's escapades have on the Australian media industry? Well, joining us now for discussion is Stephen Brook, media editor at The Australian, also part of that corporation as well. Mood on the newsroom floor, across last week, and certainly what's happened over the last 24 hours as well.
Well, I think the mood has changed a bit. It's been outrage at the revelations that have come out, and people, you know, from the chief executive down, shaking their heads that such a situation was allowed to develop. It, The Australian, which is the paper that I work for, is part of News Corporation, which also owns the News of the World, but it's a symptom of how very differently the two countries' media industries work, even though we do speak the same language. The News of the World was a rogue publication. It had a vast budget. We ran a piece in The Australian about a junior reporter who had gone over from a Sydney paper, the Sunday Telegraph, to go and work at the News of the World. And she said she couldn't believe it because checkbook journalism was rampant. It's not in Australia. She herself was handed a budget of several thousand pounds after having been there for a week and told, go out, get stories, pay people to get stories. And in Australia, newspapers aren't as profitable businesses. They don't have those kind of budgets. So they're not as competitive, also because the national media scene in newspapers is a lot smaller. The papers are a lot more metropolitan-based and aren't directly competing against one another. So really, a sense that what has happened over there has been happening in a completely different media ecosystem.
I mean, Andrew, is that part of the challenge right now? Because whether you're sitting, and, you know, certainly we've obviously seen a high-profile departure on the Dow Jones Wall Street Journal side of the business as well. That's the big challenge right now, because I would imagine if you're an advertiser, if you're a media watcher, if you are a state prosecutor, you're probably thinking that this is going on editorial floors across the company. And I guess that's the issue that has to be tackled right now.
I think certainly you'll be thinking that in the UK. And what's interesting is that, you know, there's a general feeling that many of the other tabloids have kind of slightly held their guns throughout all this debate because they know that, you know, they're not clean either. And also you just know that if you were a journalist who had worked at the News of the World and you had all these private detectives numbers in your phone, just because you changed newspapers and went somewhere else, there must have been the temptation to phone up and say, well, can you do me one more favour? You know, I need to get a number. Can you get, you know... I'm sure it spread. That may have been the centre for it in the News of the World, but I think there's a general feeling that it is going to contaminate other papers as well.
Also because of the competitive nature of Fleet Street, and if one red top suddenly was made aware that another Red Top was getting all these fantastic stories. How are they getting those stories? There would have been chit-chat. There would have been pub talk. There would have been people out on the road at stakeouts. Word would have spread. And I think that you're right, Andrew. There was, when The Guardian, which I used to work for, broke all these phone hacking stories, there was silence amongst a lot of the other Fleet Street papers and a real reluctance to engage in the story until basically the revelation about Millie Dowler's phone being hacked once again threw the floodgates wide open and a lot of very powerful people have been swept away.
I want to just move to the other part of print and just move to the magazine stand in this country. Australia, you know, has always had a tradition. I guess it's probably something to do with remoteness and maybe I think also the luxury of you know, perhaps sort of from a pop culture point of view, you know, sitting between also, you know, the US and also the UK. So it just makes the newsstand almost that much bigger here sometimes, or at least the appetite. And when I was talking to, you know, the people who work with us on the distribution side for Monocle, they were saying, you know, the market down here, and these were guys who had also spent a lot of time working in the UK. They said, the one thing is that actually the magazine market, it's been hit. It's been a tricky few years. And you know, and whether that is just consolidation we've seen in the marketplace here, what's happened digitally. But things aren't quite as bad. And I'm wondering why that is. Is that just still an appetite issue? Is sort of the digital versus print debate not as heated here? What do you make of it?
Well, Australia has traditionally been an amazing market for magazines. And you would hear stories about senior executives from Good Housekeeping coming over because they wanted to find out why the Australian Women's Weekly had such market penetration. And I remember, in my very distant past, I did some work experience at an advertising agency, and they said the Australian Women's Weekly, which is now monthly, but that's by the by, was the one media property in Australia where you could totally get to your target audience. So I think there's been a long love affair with Australian women in particular and their magazines, and that hasn't been dented by the encroaching penetration of broadband and pay television, which you'll find is much lower in Australia than in other Western countries, Britain and America, to name but two. So that love affair continues. And if you're near Amazon, there's a fantastic drama that puts everything into perspective about the magazine business in Australia, which is called Paper Giants. And that concerns a powerful female editor, Ita Buttrose, in the 1970s, who founded a magazine called Clio, which was part of the feminist wave and had a male centerfold, and how she persuaded the very conservative, masculine Packer family to set up this groundbreaking women's magazine. So there's been a lot of innovation in the market as well through the ages.
But at the same time as well, we've seen Borders close down. We've seen some other, you know, big domestic chains close down in the market here. You know, we often sort of follow, you know, and certainly the UK has been no different, but we have seen, you know, a number of now more homegrown bookstores pop up. You see sort of the strength of Daunt as a small brand also expanding. Will there be that type of reaction here? Is something going to happen at street level to fill the gap? Or is it, and you mentioned Amazon, is everyone just going to go online to buy books here?
No, I think we turn that on its head because particularly in bookshops and cafes and newsagents, there aren't the mega chains. Until Borders came in, there were a few chains, Dimmicks and Angus and Robinson's, but we don't have something like WH Smith, which is, you know, the giant UK magazine distributor. It's all locally run. We don't have chains like Costa Coffee dominating every high street. We've got a bit of Starbucks, but the individual bespoke coffee shop, bookshop, newsagents is still really alive and well in Australia and hasn't been torn down by the big sort of chain model.
Sorry, Andrew.
No, I was just going to ask you about the newsstand. What's interesting is, you know, and long may it continue, but people don't seem to mind buying shipped copies of magazines that are often like 2-3 months, you know, after they've been on sale in Europe or in the US. Why is that? Is there, you know, do people, is it just because it's a view of the outside world that people will still buy them in shipped copies?
I think that with all media consumption in Australia, and we're talking magazines, television shows, films, there's always a desire to find out what is happening in other markets, particularly it used to always be the UK, for the last couple of decades, the US. And historically, that's what Australians had to put up with. That was the only way you could get a copy of US Cosmo or UK Vogue, was to wait till it was shipped out here. Now you can get it air freighted for vastly exorbitant prices, and Australians just have to think, how badly do I want this, you know, UK version of Vanity Fair, enough to pay $20-$30 to get the air freighted copy, or am I going to wait a month or two longer? And it is a magazine after all, so you can possibly afford to wait an extra month or so to get it shipped.
While we're sitting in the headquarters of the ABC here, I just want to move to broadcast, perhaps across two elements. Discussions here, if we look at other public service broadcasters, within the Commonwealth, we see the cuts that have happened at the CBC, of course, the ongoing pressure that's on the BBC. The role of the ABC, both domestically and also, internationally, one thing that we picked up on was when you looked at the international service, the Australian network on television. It was very interesting after the earthquake in Japan, and I was sort of jumping around the region, actually seeing that because the ABC they're quite sort of well equipped in terms of having correspondents across Southeast Asia. They were able to give and put the whole issue of Japan's role, not just globally, but also the impact of the earthquake and tsunami, what impact it was going to have on the rest of the region. They did a very good job, but I was wondering, is there that recognition in Canberra as well that the ABC, has a big role to play, not just, for the people living within these borders, but also, up and down the Asia-Pacific region?
Well, you've only been here a day or two, but you've hit the nail on the head, because this is an incredibly contentious issue at the moment, which is the Australia Network, which is our version of the World Service, which has been run by the ABC for the past decade, but is funded by the government, the Department of Foreign Affairs. That is up for tender at the moment, and ABC has bid once again to run it, and this has been via satellite into Southeast Asia. Sky News, which is part owned by BSkyB in Britain, but also owned by two commercial networks here, which is Nine and Seven, begged the government to put it up for tender. They've gone for the tender. The tender result was meant to be announced, and suddenly the government's turned around and said, oh, actually, because of the situation in the Middle East and et cetera, we're now going to change the focus of the tender and put it out to tender again. So huge amount of recriminations between the ABC and Sky over who had won the tender, and has there been political interference on the part of the Labor government, which doesn't want to favour Sky, apparently wants to favour the ABC. What has got lost in all of that debate is actually the role of the Australia Network, what sort of programs it should be screening into Asia. Should it be just news and current affairs, or should it be Home and Away and Neighbours? Should it be Australian sport? And also, at the end of it, who that network is for. It's set up by the government, which, isn't a very good proprietor to have for a media entity, but a real confusion over just what its role should be and who in Asia it should be trying to reach.
Andrew, do you think there is an opportunity, having just been in Singapore, certainly we spend enough time in Northern Asia as well, and I guess from time to time we've touched on it. We've covered the power and the rise of an Al Jazeera. And does it strike you that there's a bit of a void that no one has really emerged at the surface saying, like, we're going to be the major voice? We see an opportunity, both commercially but also from an influence point of view, to be able to talk to people who are sitting in Hanoi as much as someone who's sitting in Guangzhou.
Oh, definitely. No. And what's interesting is that that natural market, that Asian market, there's two or three interesting things. One, it's increasingly a market where there's lots of people who speak English. So as you go around the region, there's a hunger for news and current affairs in English. There's also the really interesting issue that many of those societies actually have a high degree of self-censorship. So that they're not actually very good at covering local stories. They're not very good at talking about their own governments, even though there may be on paper press freedoms. So, for example, it would be great to see Australia covering the region better. And also, there is an unseemly battle in the background between governments and between China, the US, Australia, to have influence and reach within this region, and it is Australia's backyard, and it should be a natural desire to kind of be speaking to that community.
Well, I think a difficulty there, much as I do love and admire the ABC, is that it is a public broadcaster, and they have got into enormous trouble in the past by being frank about Asia and a couple of countries in particular, Malaysia. And what the difficulty is that then the Malaysians see this as not the ABC having a go, but the Australian government having a go. So that can very quickly escalate into a diplomatic incident. There was an incident a couple of decades ago with a Australian drama, which was called Embassy, which was about a diplomat in Southeast Asia. And the Malaysians decided that this fictitious country was Malaysia and were furious about it. So, yeah, Al Jazeera, it's interesting. I think if you wanted to replicate that in Australia or throughout the region, you'd need a very rich independent proprietor. It would probably have to be done privately and not under the public broadcasting system.
Mm. On that note of maybe you know, and perhaps having a more fit and able you know, private sector broadcaster, it's quite remarkable when you watch, you know, for a small market population wise like Australia, when you watch broadly, I'll call it morning news television. It wasn't so newsy when I stepped off the plane on Friday morning. But, you know, you see the sort of, I guess it struck me that sort of Channel 7 is probably the leader. They have sort of definitely it seemed like sort of the sassiest, paciest of the programs. But I guess 9 and 10 are trying to do their bit. I guess there's more of a rolling news thing from ABC. Why is that market so competitive? I mean, it almost, you know, it almost feels like the United States, even though there aren't 300 million people here, in terms of that competition that you have between the three commercial networks.
Exactly. And what happens in breakfast is a microcosm to explain our commercial free-to-air television networks, which are known as 7, 9, and 10. And we've got three, which is, you know, more than Britain in a way. They're much more long established. They're much more evenly balanced. And when I was a kid, 9 was the dominant network, and it won in everything, and it had its own version of 60 Minutes, which it still does, and it had Sunday breakfast television and throughout the week. So what you're seeing are three very commercial networks that regard news and current affairs as a real badge of honour. They rate very well as well. The evening news on Channel 7 is regularly in the top 10 programs of the night. I don't think that the BBC News could probably make that claim. And, you know, they watch each other. They're in national markets. So at breakfast time, in the evening, they have a half-hour national news, followed by half an hour of current affairs, which is something ITV would never do in a fit. They used to all have late newses, and then they've got the breakfast TV shows on the weekend as well. So in that way, it's very much like the US system. But you're right, the population in Australia is tiny compared to the US, and they don't get the millions of dollars in ad revenue.
No, I mean, you can certainly see that some of the sponsors in the morning, it's for a local glass replacement company. It's it's not a major U.S. pharma, you know, who's buying you know, space around the weather segment. Just before we go, a little bit of a quirky media question. Why is there an obsession with the road toll in this country? I mean, I think of all of the nations I travel and we visit around the world. Every time I come back, it doesn't matter whether it's Christmas time, but you know, even yesterday, I mean, someone wrapped a car around a tree in Victoria, and they're always talking about the national road toll. And it's not like some sort of new seatbelt initiative. What is it here?
Well, actually, having been a cadet reporter in this country quite a while ago now, I, over the Christmas or the Easter break, had to be the road toll reporter. And you would have a graphic of the map of Australia, and you divide it up into the states, and you would add up the numbers of fatalities that had occurred. I think it's due to a very concerted public sector, whole of government campaign to try and get those numbers down, which also involved random breath testing for alcohol, very stringently enforced, and back in the 70s, I think, compulsory seatbelts. So basically, that's part. And if you watch the Victorian government's road safety campaigns, which have been running for a very long time, extraordinarily graphic advertisements designed to stop the carnage on the nation's roads. I think in terms of obsessions, it's probably quite a good obsession to have.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But it sort of seems that something that's almost been institutionalized within newsrooms that, yeah, as you said, there's the road toll desk or the road toll editor. Steve, we're going to have to leave it there. Stephen Brook from The Australian, thanks very much.
Thank you, Tyler and Andrew.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in Sydney at the ABC. We're back after this. back with the Monocle Weekly. Well, during our stopover in Singapore earlier this week, we were struck by a headline-grabbing announcement by the Singaporean government urging homegrown businesses to get customer service inspiration from Lady Gaga. Mr. Lim Swee Say, cabinet minister in the Prime Minister's office, said that the government would be investing 84 million Singapore dollars over the next 5 years to help businesses boost customer service and become the Lady Gagas of their respective sectors. We sent our Jonathan Openshaw and Alexander Mills to meet with Mr. Peng Chong Boon, executive director of Singapore's enterprise development agency, Spring, to find out more.
First off, thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Peng. Spring, your department's recently announced a kind of huge investment in customer service, and this was announced to much fanfare as to create the Gaga effect for your various industries and sectors. Why was Lady Gaga settled on as the kind of archetype of an artist who's doing it well? And was it just for headline grabbing, or is there something serious behind what the minister was meant by the Gaga effect?
Well, what we're trying to do is really to raise the service level in the various industries in Singapore. And it's not just what we're trying to do today, but it all started in 2006, where we know that the level of service that we experience in the shops, in the restaurants, is actually not quite there. The $84 million is just the latest round of funding that the government is setting aside to continue this encouragement for the industry to try to differentiate themselves. I think Minister looked at it and used the Lady Gaga example is because he was so fascinated by Lady Gaga. She appeals to the audience in all walks of life, in different age groups. For some reason, she has that kind of magnetism. And all the fans are so impressed by her and don't question what she does, and they'll go really Gaga over her. So she has that magnetism. And the last part of the magnetism is that she tries to be what she wants to be. She doesn't bother with what other people want. I think the minister is using this as an example to really encourage the industries to say that, yes, you may be good in certain area. You may be good in service. You may be good in product. But can you make it such that your customers are so fascinated by you? Right? It becomes more like an obsession and addiction. So he's using that to try to spur some of the businesses, hopefully that they can be the Lady Gagas in their own respective area.
Interesting. Because I think, I don't know, historically, I guess, people have maybe seen Singapore as lagging behind neighbours such as Bangkok or Hong Kong when it comes to delivering this above and beyond customer service. Mm. Do you think that's a fair comment? And why do you think that might be?
First and foremost, I think the culture of the people, they are more towards the area of manufacturing. The service industry is not one where people look at it as a logical career path. So as a result, to ask the employees to come and serve the customers is not something that's natural, certainly not in the cultural context. The people that actually goes into the service line may end up going there as a career of last resort rather than as by choice. I think in the early days of our industrialization, we decided to encourage the businesses to institutionalize such a thing called service charge, which is a flat 10% for restaurants and other service. Now, as a result, you don't have a differentiated recognition to the service provider. And therefore, I think the service suffer, unlike in countries like US, where the service charge actually help determines the service. The businesses then have to start being aware of what it takes to delight customers and how do you actually exceed customer expectation. How do you compete in terms of providing value and service rather than compete in the commoditized manner?
And you mentioned that the investment is part of this move away or move in emphasis away from Singapore being kind of manufacturing base or just being a base for multinationals. What role do you see, you know, going forwards and over the next decade, maybe this kind of emphasis on developing a really strong sense of Singaporean customer service? Mm. What role do you think that's going to play in how Singapore's positioned as a kind of global player?
I think this part is going to be a very critical role because increasingly the businesses, talented individuals, professionals go not only to a place where they don't mind working in, but also a place where they can live and play. And it's all about the overall experience that they can enjoy as they come to Singapore. And in that context, it's not just about making sure that we have global companies that can offer good and professional jobs, but also making sure that we have the environment where people like to live in, the entertainment that they want, and the kind of experience that they would like to enjoy.
And so finally, I guess you've got this $84 million to invest. What are the, and you've got to drum up this kind of Gaga effect. So what are the practical things that you're going to be looking to invest in, and what are your kind of ideal outcomes over the next couple of years in different sectors?
So the $84 million, a large part of it will go towards if the companies wants to develop a new idea, have a new innovation, how can we help defray the cost of such innovation, so that it lowers the risk in the event that there's a failure. Coming up with the products or the service also requires the company to train their employees to be able to deliver that service, whether is it in terms of how to serve people better or in terms of do they have the knowledge of what they're selling, the product knowledge, the knowledge of the fabric, for example, if you're in the apparel business. Then the third component is really looking at how do we then create the opportunities for them to learn from the best practice elsewhere, organizing of conferences and sessions for companies to share with one another. And hopefully one, maybe two, will be able to generate this Lady Gaga effect. Yeah.
Brilliant. All right, well, thank you very much for your time, Mr. Pung. We'll look forward to seeing how it pans out.
Thank you.
That was our Jonathan Openshaw talking to Mr. Ping Chong Boon, Executive Director of Singapore's Enterprise Development Agency, Spring. And Andrew, it's interesting that, and it was probably not just because we were approaching that this announcement happened, but that there's a recognition in Singapore that, as we're talking at the top of the show, that they do have to up their game a little bit on the server side. And it often sort of comes up in discussion, and I said, you know, maybe part of the challenge for Singapore is that, you know, they are slightly saddled by where they sit in the world. I mean, you are, you know, just what, 100 kilometers north of the equator. So when it's almost constantly sort of 35 degrees all the time, that, you know, maybe everyone sort of needs it. You sort of enter that nap zone at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
But it's funny, isn't it? When you think back to like the 70s or the 80s, that around the world, people had associated Singapore because of its airline advertising as a nation that delivered kind of service and a very Singaporean service. And I think the other thing is, you know, that obviously, you know, Singapore is now an incredible melting pot of workers from around the world, and it also becomes more difficult delivering a kind of a seamless service message when, you know, perhaps people don't all speak the same language, etc. So it's, you can see that they have quite a lot of challenges there.
Yeah, no, it was funny when we were chatting about it the other day, and sometimes, you know, there is that notion that you can sort of, you know, mobilize you can mobilize Japan in many ways because everyone's going the same direction, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, and whether well, I sort of wonder how many people that they're trying to talk to are also, Lady Gaga listeners and downloaders, as Alex was saying, you know, whether also be sort of, you know, all wearing meat covered outfits. Anyway, you're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're in Sydney. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in Sydney, where it's time for our final guest today. A trip to Sydney would not be complete without exploring the city's mouthwatering culinary and coffee scene. Joining us now in studio, I'm very pleased to welcome food writer, author, and restaurant critic Jill Duplay. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's en route here this morning, where it would be a bit of a challenge when we do the Monocle Weekly. In fairness, we don't have a bad Aussie coffee joint around the corner from our studios in London, a place called Caffeine on Great Titchfield Street. But making the journey from the Four Seasons to here to the ABC this morning, it almost makes you a little bit depressed from a London point of view, because there are so many cozy little places on the way, and you can just see everyone, you know, doing their little weekend scene, and everyone sort of, you know, just spilling out onto the pavement. Do you think that's probably, if you look at all, you know, various exports that have come out of this country, and I'm not talking just, you know, food wise, but, you know, pop culture, mining, everything, is that probably one of the best things that the Aussies have been able to export to the world?
It's been a beautiful cycle because, of course, I grew up in Melbourne, where the Italians came in and just went, well, we've got to have coffee and we've got to do it properly and we've got to have, you know, clean the machines. And they just trained up an entire generation of people in the Italian espresso school. And that sort of just went right through. And so now I just love that Australian coffee makers and companies are moving out into the rest of the world and taking the good word with them, hopefully to Paris.
we can come back to why Paris is still such a black spot, and a black spot in a very bad way. But as you mentioned, we've heard. I guess we're close by to Toby's Estate, which of course is
Toby's is one of our great coffee companies, and you're also sandwiched near Mecca Espresso, an independent individual coffee company. And these are people who they don't want to just sell coffee. They don't want to just have a cafe. They're sourcing the beans themselves. They're roasting them themselves, often on site. And then they're looking at all the alternative new brews as well. Just any way that we can appreciate and enjoy coffee. And I just did an article for the Sydney Morning Herald on the top baristas around town. Every single one of them was 32 years old. So this is part of
culture. So, yeah, I was going to say, what kind of generational message was that? I mean, if sort of thinking 32, I guess that means that they would have been sort of born late 70s.
Well, you know what it is. In Sydney, it's the Olympic generation. These kids left school as the entire hospitality surge was it was like national service. They were conscripted into the hospitality industry because, your job stability, the place is going to go mad, restaurants opening up all over the place. As long as you can make coffee, you'll be all right, son, sort of thing. and they did. And, of course, that was a huge boom for Sydney, the Olympics. And then, of course, there's the hangover.
It's interesting, the coffee culture has obviously spread from Sydney around the world, and partly the food culture as well. But the thing that interests me about that Sydney did, it kind of created a restaurant aesthetic as well. There was a way of kind of, whether it was the beer crates outside the coffee shop where you kind of sat and had your morning coffee, or, the big communal table in a restaurant, that's been picked up all around the world. Do you think that, though, that maybe there's more things that should be coming from Sydney to go around the world in the food sense?
Things change so quickly now and are exchanged so quickly. So at the moment we're looking at a big explosion of small bars in Sydney. But is that something that... What's great about how we do them here after the legislation changed in 2008 and enabling us to do small bars is we do them so independently. Again, there's one that just does absinthe. There's one that's just doing whiskey. So that you can choose your tribe. It's very tribal, of course, or you can choose your time of day to do that. That's something... There is a sort of a style, a Sydney style to things like that.
And again, it's a very Aussie thing, isn't it? That celebration of the one product of the, whether it's the coffee bean, the coffee shop that only has one coffee bean that they promote. There's a real belief in the raw ingredients here in a way that I don't think you see elsewhere.
Growing and growing, definitely. And that's part of the zeitgeist too, of course. There is that global sort of recognition of who are we? How do we express ourselves through our own food, etc.? And we, we've had an imported culture much of our lives. I was away in London for 9 years, came back 2 years ago, and just looked at the food in Sydney going, what is Australian food? What's an Australian restaurant, etc.? And I think it is so much easier to nail in a cafe, in a bar, in a pub. We're just reinventing our pubs as just fun food, drink, cocktail bars than it is in a formal restaurant, because that's not so much a natural part of our culture.
I wanted to go back to just the point of, the time that you spent in London and, certainly being sort of one of, the key voices that really sort of helped define and bring, Australian cuisine, the Australian restaurant scene to the world. Where do you think, not just Sydney, but Australia is in its cycle right now? Because, we saw the great export of chefs around the world and then some people tried to take whole restaurants on the road as well. And as you're saying, now we've seen, not just roasting brands, we're seeing, the Aussie baristas going around the world. where are we right now, do you think?
In a very, very exciting place. I mean, you always have glimpses, sort of visions of how you want your city to be, the city that you want to live in, the Sydney you want to live in. And I'm thinking right now Sydney is on the verge of just being the most fun in the world because of this generational thing again. It's we want our young chefs and baristas and bar people to be of their generation. We don't want them to copy what's going on in the world, although they're very good at it. We want them to sort of channel everything through themselves as the filter and give us the best of the world, but give it to us in our own Australian way. We've probably got more attitude now to that, and that sort of like up you attitude that I really like, which I think is really healthy. It's a, you know, if one generation is going up you to the last, they're most likely to pick the good bits out of what was and go forward with them and then add their own thing. And that's what we're seeing now. And it just is, makes it so much fun to go to the pub and have a lagerita, massive amount of beer, ice, tequila, lime juice in a great big glass tankard, and maybe, with a grilled paella onigiri.
Oh my goodness.
Or a bull's tail empanada on the side from a proper chef in a proper kitchen, you know. Really, that's the lesson we're getting, bringing all the professionalism now, but we're having more fun.
Andrew, is that perhaps one of the, I guess, the upsides to a Sydney, to a Melbourne? There is, of course, the curse of distance, but also there's the luxury of it as well. Maybe, Jill, as you're saying, that it does also, there's an insulation that comes with isolation that, you can't just jump over and say, okay, what are they doing, over in Amsterdam or over in Hamburg at the moment, that you're able to go and sort of rip something off. And because I feel we suffer from that in London, that, it's sort of the instant concept without really, as you said, a proper kitchen, Jill. There's just nothing going on, behind the swinging door. And do you think, Andrew, that's why, Australia's been able to define everything from lagaritas to the paella? Is a paella onigiri?
A grilled paella onigiri. Okay,
we've got to go for that after lunch.
I may have to wait for my lagarita, I think, a few minutes. But and I guess also that Australia, if it has stolen, it's stolen from from Asia rather than from Europe. That's where it's stolen from. And I think it's interesting you describe those things because I think there is a downside sometimes to the way that Australian food has travelled abroad, which is I think when you see it in other places, there's this disbelief in fusion of anything. So sometimes there are things that end up on a plate that you kind of wish hadn't ended up on a plate together. And I think that's interesting because I think that what Australians are doing on a plate, they're trying to kind of amalgamate the people around them and the other countries around them. They're trying to make sense of where they are in the world on a plate. And sometimes it works amazingly. But do you think sometimes that kind of that Australian fusion craze has gone a bit too crazy?
Oh, no, I think it's gone. It's actually changed so much. I think there's a real recognition now that Australia is a part of Southeast Asia and a lot of the chefs who are going out with new menus now are second, third generation Taiwanese, Korean, Cantonese, as well as our Italian, Greek, Lebanese sort of thing. So, and their influence is so not three-star Michelin France and what's happening in the UK, as we have had in the last generation. Theirs is what their mum cooked, but can I have it in a pub? And what they had, Dave Chang of Momofuku's, their sort of poster boy, but they're doing it their way as well. It makes for an interesting time. Rather than fusing all this into the dish, though, I think the difference now is that they are, it's certainly on the menu, but it's more like an iPod, if you like, a shuffle. So we've got the best of, the world's street food, et cetera, on shuffle, on a menu, and it's up to you. But you don't have to put it. They're not necessarily, this fusion thing is, I don't know, I think it's dead. But it's transformed into a new form of...
Okay.
Yeah.
Jill, just before we go, for our listeners, if someone is boarding their Qantas or Singapore flight, and they were inbound to Sydney at the moment. Five places, from wine bars to breakfast. Give us five. What's interesting? What's happening here right now?
I'd say you have to go to like flagship Rockpool in the Rocks for the lobster congee, because my radar's always out for Australian food, and that to me is a fusion, if you like, of great Cantonese from a chef who loves Chinese, enriched with brilliant Australian produce. So that sort of thing. And then a local pub, the Carrington in Surry Hills, home of the bull's tail empanada, et cetera. Visceral, fabulous, unique restaurant called Porteño, run by two rockabilly young chefs who are so focused. They don't do TV. They don't do cookbooks. They just spear whole carcasses, whole beasts over on an asado sort of roast on over coals for 8.5 hours, beautiful lamb pedigree, beautiful pork, and then I've got the butcher's saw to cut it up, throw it on planks and get it out there with Argentinian wine and cocktails and hostesses in gloves and frocks.
You and I will be going there. We won't be taking Andrew for the big beast on a grill, but yeah. I will join you for that.
Yeah.
Breakfast?
Breakfast, Three Blue Ducks in Bronte. Fabulous. All the boys whizzing around the kitchen, just doing so simple, lovely things like avocado and tomato on toast, which if you order it anywhere else in the world is crap. And you have it in Sydney and you just go, oh, this is so good.
Yeah, I think that has to be actually one of the other great exports, because it's something which, you know, we try in our own little way, you know, in the kitchen as well. And I think that we've managed to, I don't want to say sort of fusionize, but we've been using a very good Finnish flatbread, then with really good avocado and tomato, a bit of Aussie olive oil. It's quite beautiful.
Yeah, lovely, yeah. Lovely. And just, and you'd need just a sort of a medium restaurant where it's a neighborhood thing and it's all about good veggies and fruit, etc. And that would be any one of the Cafe Sopras. It's a little bracelet. It's not a chain, it's a bracelet. there's only three, almost four, but it's that wonderful combination of a fruit and veg shop where the chef just comes out and grabs the eggplants and goes and puts them on the grill or throws them into pasta. So very much an Italian style. But the connection back to the produce and therefore the land, the grower, et cetera, is much more short and sweet.
Jill Duplay, I think you've forced us. Andrew, you're lucky that you're staying until Monday.
I'm writing down all these places. I've got my next 2 days planned.
Good.
Thanks very much. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly in Sydney. We're back with a few words right after this. You're back with the Monocle Weekly in Sydney, where it's almost time to say goodbye. Are you lining up for your Lagarita now, Andrew?
My God, that list of places. I literally was scribbling them down, thinking this is my schedule for the next.
Tomorrow morning, or at least probably Monday morning, you'll be. I'm sure you're gonna be at Three Blue Ducks, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, I love avocado toast. It's one of my.
I'm not going to drag you to Porteño, am I?
No, I'm not the big. I don't want to see that big butcher's knife.
But tonight we can go to 121 BC.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
That is the incredible, exciting. I mean, truly, the exciting thing about being here, though, is I like that how Jill sort of, you know, contextualized this whole notion of what happened with, you know, the Olympics generation and how that has really defined a generation of service here.
Yeah, and
well, hopefully that will happen in London.
If it happens in London, that'd be a miracle. But I think it is amazing what's happened here. And I also do love. Yeah, of course, I love the food and the coffee and the drinks and things, but I do love the aesthetic of how people make places here, because that same independent vibe. Places don't all look the same. They're not all kind of, you know, buying their restaurant furniture from the same places.
It's a nice theme from today's show, because I think Stephen Brook was talking about that as well. I mean, that there is a bit of a pushback against the chains here.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Sydney is it's designed for independence, because, you know, when you go to a place like Paddington, there's lots of small store fronts. You don't have to take on an epic space when you start up a company or you start up a little cafe. It's just built for independence. It's amazing.
I think the whole place sort of is spiritually lobbied for a bureau here, hasn't it?
Yeah, I might even post myself, I think.
Exactly. Anyway, that's all for this 108th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineer was Martin Peralta here at the studios of ABC in Sydney. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us out to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our Monocle column on our website. But for now, from Sydney, I'm Tyler Brulé.
And I'm Andrew Tuck.
And we're in Tokyo next week. Goodbye.